I am always disappointed to see garbage. When I go to the beach, I usually collect it and put it in the nearest litter bin. The truth is, I just don't like to see my daughter and her friends sharing the water with rubbish. But the garbage you see is only part of the problem. There's a whole lot more that's not visible. Microplastics, small pieces either washed into the ocean or created as larger pieces of floating garbage disintegrate. Now, collecting tiny pieces by hand is all but impossible, and here is the real horror story. These pieces are small enough to be ingested by sea creatures. What's more, harmful chemicals like DDT, remember that, and PCBs cling to this plastic, essentially forming a pill of concentrated poisons. The fact is, we are making a terrible mess of the ocean. But I am optimistic that we can fix it, that determined scientists and generous volunteers will pull together to save the world. And of course, already there are numerous initiatives aimed at doing just that. Today we are going to learn all about one of those initiatives. But it is a big one, and you can help. On the line is Abby Barrows. Abby is a marine research scientist based in Maine on the east coast of the United States. It's more accurate to say she's based on an island off the coast of the United States, just shy of the Canadian border. Abby runs the Microplastics Lab for an organization you may have heard of called Adventure Scientists. Abby, welcome to Boat Radio. First of all, microplastics. How do we define what is a microplastic?
Microplastics are defined as a piece of plastic that is less than 5 millimeters in size. So if you want to imagine, half of your pinky fingernail is about 5 millimeters. So very small pieces of plastic. And for the most part, what I'm looking at are microscopic pieces, pieces you can't really see with the naked eye.
So what are we talking about here? Are we talking about small squares of plastic, you know, broken toy cars or basins or synthetic fibers? What sort of thing are we looking at?
We are predominantly finding fibers, and that is becoming a global trend in research studies all over the world. We have processed almost 2,000 samples to date globally, and 90% of those samples have contained some sort of plastic, and 90% of the plastics that we are quantifying we are counting as microfibers. So those tiny little hair-like pieces of plastic that are typically coming from synthetic clothing, fishing line, we're not sure exactly where.
So while bottles and bags and the often photographed six-pack rings or those six-pack yolks that hold your six cans of Coke or beer together, they are a problem for the environment, but they can't be digested because they're not small enough. And that's the problem, isn't it, with these microplastics? Animals are eating them.
Yes, well, so the big thing with microplastics is every plastic out there will eventually become a microplastic. So we are looking at both types of plastics. We're looking at primary microplastics, so plastics that were created at the micro level. So all nurdles, so these little round plastic pellets, are sort of the feedstock for building and creating all the plastics that we use in our everyday lives. So those are shipped around the world in container ships, and those are often spilled into the environment. So those are primary microplastics.
So, sorry, just to clarify, those are little beads of plastic in all different colors.
Often clear, and they're just the building blocks for making Tupperware or computer cases, and they are shipped to petrochemical factories that add in the chemical additives to mold them into the different products that we use.
Right, so these are plastic raw materials that are shipped to factories around the world.
And also in boatyards, you often hear about sandblasting. Unfortunately, the sandblasting is not usually sand anymore. It's plastic pellets, which is an abrasive to blast off animals that have fouled the hull of your boat, or if you want to take your bottom paint off, that is often used under high pressure to blast those things off the boats, and there's no great way for containing those. And as you know, most boatyards are on the water, so that's another source of primary microplastics. And the other one that is mostly recently been in the news and was recently signed into law by Obama in 2015 to ban the sale of microbeads in personal care products. So microbeads are those small little round pellets in face wash and toothpaste that act as an abrasive to remove dead skin and things like that. So those will now be being phased out of personal care products, and we will not be seeing those as primary microplastics, hopefully, in our waterways and in our seafood as frequently in the near future.
Because I think a lot of people don't know about that. They don't realize that when they're, exfoliating, I think is the term.
Yes.
They're actually rubbing. It's not ground up apricot stones or whatever they think it is. It's actually little bits of waste plastic.
Yes, and you really have to dig at looking in the ingredients to find that out. So now with this new law passed, it'll make it easier for a consumer to make a choice that is not going to be harmful to the environment in terms of contributing primary microplastics into our waters. So secondary microplastics, I still think that you can look at a lot of the single-use plastics, so plastic bags and bottles and six-packs rings, all of those can break down into what we call secondary microplastics. So larger pieces of plastic that break down over time through UV degradation, through different types of weathering, through freezing, being nibbled at by animals. Those all break down to the microscopic level eventually.
Why is it that DDT and other harmful chemicals, pesticides and that sort of thing, cling to plastic in the ocean? How does that work?
I'm not a toxicologist, but my understanding is that we have all of these persistent organic pollutants, these legacy compounds, so DDT, PCB, PAHs, brominated flame retardants, all of these chemicals really hang out for a long time in our environment. And they are throughout our water, all over the world, freshwater and marine. And these chemicals are sort of just ambient, floating around. And they're not very attracted to water molecules. So they're considered hydrophobic for the most part. But they love fats, whether that be the fatty tissue of a fish or a human, or the bonds in plastic, which mimic fats. So most plastic is made from petroleum, oil-based, which acts as a type of fat molecule, in a sense, in the environment. So these plastics float around, and they attract these persistent organic pollutants. So over time, this very tiny little, seemingly insignificant piece of plastic absorbs chemicals many magnitudes higher than the surrounding seawater or fresh water. So it ends up being this very toxic little sponge with high surface area that has picked up all of the nasties as it's made its way through our waterways. And what's frightening about that is not only is it now carrying a high level of these chemicals, but you think about what might be happening to these chemicals when they are ingested by animals.
Can you give us any idea at all of the scale of the problem we're talking about? I'm not talking about plastic bottles and flip-flops and bits of polystyrene from fish freezing boxes floating around in the sea. I'm talking about the microplastic particles. Have you any idea at all of the scale of it?
Well, to give you an idea, almost everywhere that researchers have looked around the world for microplastics, whether it be in a remote mountain stream or a lake, or the middle of the ocean, or some remote island, we have found plastic. So that gives you an idea that these many of the environments that we might call quote-unquote pristine, we have traveled to or have had adventurers travel to and collect water samples, and I have been disappointed every time to find that even these very remote areas that you would think would be maybe untouched by plastic pollution have high levels of contamination, or at least some level of contamination. So on average, we're finding about 7 pieces of plastic per liter of water that we collect. So that's averaged across our fresh water and our marine samples. We tend to find more plastics in our marine samples and less in our fresh water. But the study is still ongoing, so those aren't final results at this point.
Per liter, let's...
Like a Coke bottle.
Yeah, Yeah, it's 2 pints, isn't it? It's a medium sized drinking water bottle or fizzy drink bottle.
Yeah.
Tell us about Adventure Scientist. What does the organization do? What's the mission?
Our mission is to address some of the world's most pressing environmental challenges in which access to physical data is crucial to resolving them. So we do this through leveraging the skills of the outdoor adventure community. They are uniquely able to gather difficult-to-obtain data at any scale in any environment. So for the microplastics initiative, I have been utilizing the adventure community based on the water. So anyone from kayakers to rowers to sailors to scuba divers and even hikers who are hiking in remote areas that might have access to a body of water. All of these people have volunteered for this project to follow strict protocols, collect water samples, and then ship them to my lab where I process them to look for microplastic content.
Wow, all these people are volunteers, but they all obviously, they really care about the environment. They spend their time in the environment.
Yes, and that's why I think that Adventure Scientist is unique in the sense that it's a bit of a step up from citizen science in that adventurers are already experts in being out in the elements, and they have access and or the drive to get to locations that most everyday people might not have access to. So we tap into that. And most of these people have a great love for the outdoors. So they're able to go on their extreme adventure, do something epic, but also collect meaningful data that can really help shed more light on issues that are still not very well understood.
Do you think it's the case that there are more and more people undertaking these kind of adventurous holidays? You know, women kayaking up the Orinoco River, guys walking across the Bering Straits when it's frozen. You know, all that sort of stuff that seems, you know, kind of quite extreme. You know, people come back with big beards.
I'm not sure if there's an upward trend in it. I think it might just be better covered than it used to be. But if there is an upward trend, it will definitely help contribute to projects with adventure scientists. So either way, I'm more and more happy that there are people out there willing to go on these sort of extreme expeditions and willing to take the time and go through the protocols to collect data while they're out there.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest today is marine research scientist Abby Barrows. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, I'll be asking her all about her background and how she got involved with Adventure Scientists.
Bonny Lass Charters is Mallorca's number one experience.
Bonny Lass is a 57-foot converted fishing boat. She was built in 1949 as a herring ring netter in Scotland, and now she's set up for the Mediterranean. Apart from just relaxing in the sunshine on the deck, there's paddleboarding and any kind of exploring you can imagine up along the north coast of Mallorca here, quite often with Maggie the dog in tow as well. Bonny Lass Charters is unique because no charter is really the same. We work really hard to make it the perfect day for each individual client. To be able to go out and enjoy the day with the guests on board is just fantastic.
For more information and to make a booking, visit bonnylasscharters.com.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. With me today is marine research scientist Abby Barrows, based on Deer Isle off the coast of Maine near the US border with Canada. Abby runs the microplastics lab for an organization called Adventure Scientists. So, Abby, how did you get involved with this? What's your background?
Well, growing up on an island, now living on an island, the ocean has always been a really big part of my life. So I ended up going to school for zoology and really focusing on marine biology while I was undertaking that course, and always kept the ocean very close to me, whether geographically or in my mind at least. I did a lot of traveling and research all over the world, in the South Pacific and the Caribbean and South America and Australia, and there was one very common theme throughout all of those locations, and that was plastic pollution. Everywhere I was, it was impacting the animals I was researching, from sea turtles to seahorses. It was impacting the people where I lived, And it just seemed like this overwhelming issue that was not going away anytime soon. So with that in mind, I eventually planted my feet back in Maine and started doing research within the Gulf of Maine and sort of stumbled into microplastic research about 4.5 years ago. I had run into a student who had been doing a research project through the Sea Education Association out of Woods Hole in Massachusetts, Woods Hole Oceanographic Institute. And it really, a light bulb went off for me. I thought, I live in the fishing community. I have a marine biology background. What is going on with this thing called microplastics? Is it in our waters? Is it in our seafood? So I started doing pretty active research looking at the distribution and potential sources locally where I lived, and also conducting a seafood research study looking at some of the commercial seafood species that we all know and love, such as lobster and clams and oysters and mussels. And I just kept on being blown away at the sheer quantity of plastics that I was finding everywhere I looked. So in 2013, I heard about Adventure Scientists. I filled out their little form. It was something like, are you a scientist looking to have more of a global impact with your data set? And I'm like, absolutely. That the more samples I could get from around the world, the better I could understand this major issue. So in 2013, I filled out the form, and I think within that day, Greg Trinish was on the phone with me, and we Skyped and talked about the project, and it seemed like a perfect match. So the project continued to develop. I think we had our first samples arrive in June 2013 from Thailand, and we ironed out the protocols, we did troubleshooting, we tried to make it as, we have made it as quality assured with the data and a very strict protocol in the field to make sure that the data is something that we can stand behind. So the project has developed since then, and last spring, we expanded into freshwater systems as well. So now we have collected, as I said before, almost 2,000 samples from around the world in both marine and freshwater systems.
This global microplastic initiative, which I didn't realize you started it. I mean, you got Adventure Scientists involved in it. I mean, is it just a first step? I mean, is it simply you're measuring the problem rather than finding a solution to it?
Well, we hope to do the two in tandem. So without having data, it's very hard to have people believe that there is a real issue. So now that the project is a few years on, we plan on analyzing. We are not an advocacy organization, but we do want to collect good data that then can be used by legislators, policymakers, stakeholders, general public to help reduce single-use plastic in their communities with the overall goal of reducing pollution in our waterways.
So tell us how it works. You receive, what, flasks of water at your lab, bags of garbage, or?
It might seem a little crazy, but I receive boxes of 1-liter bottles of water. We haven't been able to troubleshoot a more effective way to collect samples and filter them in situ because contamination is such a huge issue in this field of research. You think about, you look at sunlight in your house and there's fibers and things floating in the air. There's microplastics in the air. It's an airborne contaminant as well. So it's something that we have to constantly be very aware of on every step of our research project. So the best way to mitigate contamination has been for me to receive the water in my contamination-free lab, process them under very strict clean protocols, and so to walk you through the steps, I get a box of water, open it up. There's data sheets associated, obviously, with all the sampling. So we have latitude and longitude. We have depth of sample. We have water temperature, a bit of metadata. So what's going on in the area that you sampled? Was it an industrial area, etc.? And then I open up those samples and process them using a vacuum pump filtration method, which is basically a stacked glassware. And I pour the water into a flask and then pump it through a 0.45 micron gridded filter. So a very, very fine mesh filter, hopefully capturing everything larger than 0.45 microns. And then I take that filter off the glass apparatus and use a microscope to move through the gridded filter and quantify the plastic that I find based on shape, color, and size.
Right. So you're not simply counting the number of little pieces of plastic that you find in each liter of water that you are sent. You're actually categorizing that plastic too.
Yes. It's very time consuming, but after 2,000 samples, you get pretty efficient at it. We also pull off some of the larger pieces, actually just a subsampling across our marine and freshwater samples to do polymer characterization, so to find out what type of plastic we're looking at. So those samples, those pieces of plastic get sent out to labs where they use different types of machinery, so a Raman spectrophotometer or a FTIR, basically these mass spec machines to quantify the plastic. And that also can tell us on occasion what types of chemicals have adhered to that plastic as well. So that's sort of the next step that we have stepped into, doing more polymer characterization of our plastic samples, but we are now doing more of the chemical characterization as well, so we can really understand what are the hazardous chemicals associated with these microplastics that we're finding in all these different places in the world.
You mentioned earlier on that you've been to all sorts of far-flung places all over the world, and that you were always disappointed. You always found these contaminants. You always found bits of plastic in the water. I mean, is it the case that the world's oceans now, they're just a thin soup of plastic pieces, like minestrone?
Yes, I've heard plastic soup being thrown around as a term. I've heard plastisphere. I've heard plastic smog. It does seem that there is a thin layer of plastic across all of our surface waters in the ocean and in our fresh water. It might not be consistently distributed because there's a lot of different factors at play in terms of currents and wind, and there's a lot of different factors that we're still just beginning to understand in terms of the distribution of plastic. But I would say that we are living in a plastic age, and our environment is reflecting that.
It's possible, of course, for people to help. And by that, I don't mean going out on an adventure and collecting samples for you. I mean, it's possible for people to help passively by changing even slightly their behavior. I suppose particularly their shopping habits. Is that right? Is that the reasonable thing to say? I mean, what...
Yes.
What's the best first move that somebody listening to this could make? Stop buying bottled water.
That's definitely a great first step. Unfortunately, there is no silver bullet for this, but I think just being aware of your personal everyday use of plastic. Do you really need to grab that bottle of water? Why don't you get a reusable bottle and fill it up on the tap? Do you need that shopping bag? Bring a cloth bag. Do you need that exfoliating face wash? Why don't you look for a natural alternative? There's also bigger picture things you can do. You can become more aware of what's happening in your town or in your region. Is there a push to reduce single-use plastics? Is there something that you can do to help to support a local ordinance or write your, you know, everyone says it, but it can make a big difference if you write your local representative or your senator and say, hey, I'm your constituent and I'm really concerned about this issue. So I think being vocal and actions speak really loudly as well. When you go to a restaurant, say no straw, please. We're adults. We don't really need a straw for our drink. There's a lot of plastic that's just a knee-jerk thing that we don't really realize that we're using it as to excess, and that's the issue here. Plastic can be a wonderful and very versatile material, but we are using it to excess.
You know, I read once that even though you might sort these plastic drinking water bottles, the clear, crackly plastic bottles, and put them into your recycling, the overwhelming majority are not actually recycled. They end up in landfill or blowing around in the street and ending up in our water courses. I mean, is that right?
Yes, that is correct. And that is a sad fact, especially in the U.S., where our recycling rates are below 5%. And currently, at least 8 tons of plastic leak into the ocean every minute, which is sort of equivalent to dumping a garbage truck full of plastic straight into the sea. So that's even with people with good intentions. They put it in the bin, they put it in the bin to go to the recycling facility or to the landfill. A lot of that plastic doesn't make it where it's supposed to go. And even if it does make it where it's supposed to go, a lot of those disposable plastic products are still a problem, regardless of whether or not they are broken down and reused.
So just to cut in and reiterate that, that is a whole garbage truck filled with plastic tipped into the ocean every minute. And the US is one of the worst culprits. Which countries are the biggest offenders?
So that's a really hard thing to quantify. There was a study that recently came out, but it has to do with how much coastline you have and what type of infrastructure you have set up for processing waste. So without pointing fingers, I think that we can just point the fingers at all of our countries because we all use plastics to excess.
Sure. How would somebody listening go about getting involved in Adventure Scientist's Global Microplastics Initiative? How could somebody help you?
Well, they can go to our website, which is adventurescience.org, and they can click through to the Microplastics Initiative, and there's a big button that says sign up. And it's very straightforward, and you fill out a few bits of information about who you are, why you're interested, and where you would be going and collecting samples. And we would love to hear from you and love to get more samples and really fill in that global map of...
I was going to mention your map, actually, because you've got a lovely map. I love maps. And you've got a lovely map of the world on your website. And there's a little dot, bigger dots where more samples have been collected, but little dots all over the map. And I noticed there are quite a few gaps where you would think, in fact, that you would have plenty of people to help you. Like, so for Western Australia, for example, and much of the south coast of Australia, you don't appear to have had any samples collected. So are there particular places, and should potential volunteers have a look at that map and think, actually, I could go there?
Absolutely, and maybe it will help decide someone's trip. Yes, so we do have samples that are en route and or being processed from some of those areas in Australia. But we are always looking for more, especially within the Indian Ocean, as you see, is undersampled, and the Southern Ocean. The Southern Ocean is a little bit more of a difficult place to get to, but we are very undersampled there.
Yes, I was going to say it's rather forbidding for a holiday, the Southern Ocean, I would have thought.
Yes. And also, as you'll notice, Russia is very undersampled. Russia has an amazing amount of coastline, and also the freshwater systems. So I think that as looking at the map is helpful, you can see where some areas have been heavily sampled, but we're still really understanding microplastics movement and distribution. So even areas that have been sampled or areas near areas that have been sampled, there probably will be a high amount of microplastic variation in terms of contamination. So more samples help us better understand that amount of variation in each of those areas. So sample away.
And do people receive a kit of some sort or just instructions?
Just instructions, because we have made this as user-friendly as possible. It's really low technology. Basically, you watch a protocol video and take a quiz, a test, to make sure you're actually watching the video. And really, you just need to have some bottles that you will pre-prep before you go out in the field and a few other instruments at your disposal, such as a GPS of some sort, because we need to know where that sample has come from. So most people who are doing some sort of trekking or sailing have easy access to a GPS system. So really, it's having the foresight to prep some bottles and have things ready to go. But we have digitized our sampling platform. So when you're out in the field, you can use your smartphone, if you have one, even when you don't have a Wi-Fi connection, to upload your data in real time. So it's really great. We can just see data coming in all day, 24/7, from different places around the world as people plug in their samples before the the water arrives to my lab, I can already see where samples have been taken. So we've tried to make it as streamlined as possible, but still keeping a very strict eye on quality assurance.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. My guest today is marine research scientist Abby Barrows. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, I'll be asking about solutions to this microplastics problem.
Our aim at Street Invest is to put a trustworthy adult into the lives of street children so that they can support them in creating the most positive paths for their lives in the future. We work around the world, working on the street with the children where they are. For such a large group of children, the amount of funding available is tiny. Really, the funding that keeps organisations like Street Invest going comes from individual donors. Street children are the most abused, neglected, violated children, yet they are also the most resourceful, responsive and resilient children that we could have the honour of working with.
For more information or to make a donation, visit streetinvest.org.
You're listening to Boat Radio. I'm Mike McDowell. With me today is marine research scientist Abby Barrows. Abby runs the Microplastics Lab for Adventure Scientists. Abby, how long will you continue to work on the Global Microplastics Initiative? I mean, is it a never-ending survey?
I think that you could look at it as a never-ending survey, but our goal is really to use this data to drive changes for solutions. So there will be an endpoint, at least for our surface water collection of the marine data set. We might be moving into other aspects of microplastics research, which will help fill in some of those knowledge gaps that are now being recognized by the international community.
How on earth, somebody somewhere must be trying to think of a solution, how on earth are we supposed to prevent this from happening? Because, I mean, when you were talking about microfibers earlier on, so like man-made synthetic nylon fibers, that sort of thing. When you launder your clothes in a washing machine, you must be scooting loads of microfibers into the drain, which ultimately makes its way to sea.
Yes. So that is a fact that most people are not yet aware of, that every time you wash your running clothes or your yoga pants or your polar fleece jacket, that is shedding thousands and thousands of pieces of microfibers, which are not being collected because we just don't have the systems in place. In our personal washing machines or in our municipal wastewater treatment plants. An analogy to think about this problem without getting too overwhelmed was nicely highlighted by my friend Chelsea Rockman. She said, if you're in your house and your water pipe has burst and it's just spewing water all over your house, puddles are everywhere, what do you do first? You go to the source. You turn off the water, right? So in this case, we turn off the tap of plastic pollution. We try to prevent it from making its way into the water because it's a much bigger issue to clean up the oceans than to stop it while it's still on land. But you also don't want to leave these puddles of water all over your house. So you turn off the tap of water, or in this case, plastic, and then you go around and you figure out smart ways to clean up what is out there. So I think that there are a lot of great people working really hard on thinking about viable solutions to this issue. Beach cleanups and roadside cleanup, all of these things help reduce the amount of macroplastics, the larger pieces of plastics, from getting to the waterways. Because once it's in the water, it is much more expensive, energy and time consuming to clean up. So getting involved in local cleanups is a great thing. Reducing your own plastic footprint, really important. Talking to people about plastic and plastic pollution. Also, there's a few people that have been really working hard to innovate and think of clever ways to still be able to use a lot of these products that we love so much, So our, you know, our Gore-Tex jackets and things that are great for outdoor sports. So a few different companies have been trying to make stronger fibers and weave them with natural so they last longer and don't shed so much when you wash them. And also, I'm actually on American Promise, which is a boat owned by the Rosalia Project, and they have just developed a fiber catcher. It was inspired by corals and anemone, and it's this ball that you throw into your washing machine, and when you are washing your synthetic clothing, it helps capture a large amount of those fibers that would normally make their way out in the wastewater. So there are a lot of different people thinking about this, but it is not a straightforward one solution fits all. I think that it needs to be a multi-tiered approach. There needs to be research happening. There needs to be policy changes. And there also needs to be boots on the ground, mitigation and reduction of plastic.
We should also point out, shouldn't we, that in actual fact, for those entrepreneurial spirits out there, there's money to be made from environmentally friendly solutions to these problems. You know, in the news recently was a brilliant idea from Florida's Saltwater Brewery, and it's a six-pack yoke. So one of those six rings that holds your cans together, but it's made from barley, essentially the leftovers from the brewing process. It's totally biodegradable, and it's compostable, and it is fish food. The fish can eat it. It's borderline genius. And presumably there are more terrific ideas out there. What should the entrepreneurial spirits out there listening focus on if we're to reduce the concentration of microplastic particles in the ocean?
Well, that's a good question. I think that we need to be aware that we are not going to stop using plastic tomorrow. So I think thinking about those items that really we use every day and that are contributing largely to plastic pollution. So thinking about alternatives to bags, which is pretty straightforward. People have been using natural materials, but other objects that it might not be the first thing that pops into your head, but thinking about ways to invent some creative alternatives that will be having much less of an impact on our environment for some of those single-use plastics.
Looking for luxury accommodation in Mallorca, but don't want to pay high summer prices? Well, Mallorcan Tonic, the low-season luxury hotel booking website, is here to help. We can save you hundreds of euros on your hotel choice, making sure you enjoy exceptional accommodation at a fraction of the summer rates. In addition, each of our hand-picked hotels offers tempting low-season incentives, including further discounts, room upgrades, and complimentary cava on arrival. Whether you choose the buzz of Palma, cool coastal views, or the magnetism of the mountains, we have a hotel to suit you. You can also book our favourite restaurants, from local eateries to Michelin stars, each offering a free glass of cava. And there's lots of helpful hints about what to do during your visit. So if you're missing your sunshine fix and want to beat the winter blues, then click on MallorcanTonic.com and let us find you your dream hotel and save you money.